Welcome to Session 7 of Mind in the Cosmos. The title of this session is Multiple Ways of Knowing. Up until now, we've explored cosmology and consciousness from the perspective of ontology, a study of the nature of being, or the nature of reality. In this session, we will shift perspective and begin to look at consciousness and cosmology through the lens of epistemology, that is, the study of how we know anything at all. We will pay particular attention to what it means to have different ways of knowing, such as sensory perception, rationality, feeling, intuition, and even what the ancient Chinese called wu, or no knowledge. We will show how Arthur Young's reflexive arc is also a way of understanding a hierarchy of ways of knowing, and how each level of being requires its own mode of knowing to gain access to that level. I'd like to begin by giving an overview of what I call the four gifts of reason. The four gifts of knowing. The first is the philosopher's gift of reason. The second is the scientist's gift of sensory empiricism, of observation using the senses, and it's a gift of method, the scientific methodology. The third gift is the shaman's gift of feeling, of knowing the world through feeling the world and our relationship with the world and all its creatures. And the fourth way of knowing is the mystic's gift, the gift of intuition, of direct experience with the divine, with the sacred, with the ultimate. So let's begin by pointing out that really what we're hoping to achieve in this particular session is a kind of owner's guide to consciousness. It's designed to help sort out the tangles and the knots that philosophers and scientists often get into when trying to explore the mind. First, we will learn how the philosopher's gift of clear thinking opens the way to talk about what consciousness is. And next, we will look at the scientist's gift of observation and method, and how this way opens the way for investigating how the mind works. Then we will shift focus to look at the shaman's gift of embodied feeling, and how trusting in the wisdom of the body, our own body, the great body of the earth, and the greater body of the cosmos itself, how trusting in the wisdom of the body opens the way for exploring more of the subtle realms of being and of why the mind works. And then finally, we will explore the mystic's gift of intuition and transcendence, and how this may lead into a silent clearing of consciousness, the unspeakable domain of spirit, rich with meaning and purpose. And this will help reveal who works the mind. So the philosopher's gift of clear thinking will inform us about what consciousness is. The scientist's gift of observation and method will help us understand how the mind works. And the shaman's gift of embodied feeling will help us understand why the mind works the way it does. And finally, the mystic's gift of intuition and transcendence will help reveal who works the mind. So let's begin with the philosopher's gift. As I mentioned, the philosopher's gift is the gift of clear thinking. It's an investigation of what consciousness is. And it begins by reminding us that consciousness is our most intimate reality, yet it is also our deepest mystery. Everybody has a mind, yet few of us really know how to talk about it, or write about it, or think about it. If we're asked about its nature, we quickly discover the limitations of language. If we're asked how it works, we either talk about the brain or about behavior, or else we are left scratching our heads. If we wonder how to develop this ghostly faculty, launching ourselves to new spiritual heights, again, we are often at a loss for words. Well, today the talk in philosophy of mind is how to crack what's called the hard problem, to explain how consciousness is related to matter and how brains scintillate with mental events. Shelf loads of books have been written to that claim to explain or rediscover the nature of consciousness. But these books are mostly either too technical or else they fail to deliver on their promise of explaining consciousness. Now, in this course, I've tried to unpack the most difficult problems in consciousness and to discuss them in simple, non-technical language to guide us on our journey into philosophy's deepest mystery and science's final frontier. So, let's look at the philosopher's gift of clear meaning. And let's begin with first things first. In any conversation, but particularly conversations about consciousness, clarity depends most of all on getting our meaning straight. As we learned in the previous session, so much talk about consciousness is confusing because our words can mean many different things. For now, we will approach the question of consciousness philosophically, because philosophers are the professionals when it comes to meaning. However, it may be helpful here to note two different kinds of meaning. There's symbolic meaning and there's experienced meaning. And let's take a look at how they relate to each other. We're going to take a look at the meaning of meaning. As I said, philosophers are the experts when it comes to meaning, especially the meaning of words. But there is another kind of meaning, one that matters most to many of us, and that is the meaning of life. This second kind of meaning is more the domain of the sage than the philosopher, though, of course, one does not exclude the other. Well, the two kinds of meaning are symbolic meaning and experiential meaning. Symbolic meaning is when philosophers search for meaning in language. They explore what words mean and how words and ideas can refer to other words and ideas, or how they represent things in the world. For instance, the word ball is a sound or image that refers to a spherical object. The word ball itself, however, is not spherical. Words don't have shapes, and therefore words can be very different from the things they mean. Words are symbols. They point to or signify something else, something beyond themselves. Language, philosophers are fond of reminding us, is a symbolic system. So the philosopher's kind of meaning is linguistic or symbolic. Philosophers are experts in answering questions such as, what do words mean? That is, bridging the gap between the word and what it refers to or symbolizes. And this is a very useful gift to master when we want to make ourselves clearly understood, especially about difficult, abstract ideas and concepts. So the second kind of meaning, experienced meaning. Sages and mystics search for a different, deeper kind of meaning. They explore whether life and the universe has meaning. For them, meaning is not a question of which words refer to which things, but what meaning or meanings do individual lives and the whole cosmos have in themselves. This kind of meaning is intrinsic. It is part of the nature of a thing in itself. It is direct meaning, not merely symbolic, and it is experienced as something worthwhile in itself. It is closely related to experiences of purpose and value. Now, both kinds of meaning do have something in common. They both refer to what is beyond themselves. In the case of language, words have meaning because they refer to things beyond the words themselves. In the case of a person's life, the life gets its meaning within the larger context of the world or the cosmos as a whole. Our life, as it is actually concretely lived and experienced, not just as an abstract word, idea, image, concept, or symbol, our life gets its meaning from participating as a part of a greater whole, whether in time or space or beyond. Thus, although it may be true to say that your life has intrinsic meaning, that is, it is meaningful in and of itself, such meaning gets its richness from its interconnectedness and interdependence with the whole. For instance, if we feel disconnected from the whole, whether life as a whole, the universe as a whole, our existence as a whole, we feel that our life has lost its meaning. The more we feel connected with the whole, the more we experience life to be rich with meaning and possibilities. So the first kind of meaning is philosophical, where meaning depends on symbolic connections grasped by reason. The second kind of meaning is psychological, mystical, or spiritual, where meaning depends on experienced connections revealed through intuition or mystical insight. This is not to say that philosophers never concern themselves with the deeper kind of meaning. Many of them do, especially those who follow in the tradition of Socrates and Plato. But when writing or talking about the deeper kind of meaning, they recognize the great value of paying attention to symbolic meaning. It is one thing to experience meaning, it is something else to talk about it, or to talk about our experiences. When we feel moved to talk or write or think about our experience, it helps greatly if we make use of the philosopher's gift of reason. The tools of the philosopher's trade are logic and analysis, sharpened by the rigor of precision. And we can take advantage of the work that they have done, particularly some of the magnificent discoveries they have revealed about the mind. Now, unfortunately, sometimes philosophers probe so deeply into the fine structure of language that it takes a trained and diligent mind to follow the twists and turns of their arguments. Often in the process, simple clarity and meaning get lost in a fog of conceptual gymnastics that leave ordinary folk more confused than enlightened. It's not so surprising, then, that many people show no interest in what philosophy has to say. It all seems so unrelated to real life. But good philosophers not only dive deep, they also return to the surface with polished nuggets of insight, pried loose from the bedrock of language and reason, sparkling with the wisdom of intuition and lived experience. These philosophers still speak to us because they take care to talk our language. They know the power of metaphor, and have the ability to balance rational precision with the evocative ring of poetic language. But such philosophers are a rare breed. Many, perhaps even most, books on consciousness by philosophers are by specialists for specialists trained in the remote language of analysis. Meaning and clarity suffer, leaving non-specialist readers blinded and bewildered in dust storms of dry logic. But it would be a mistake to dismiss and ignore the contribution that philosophy can make to our understanding of consciousness. In the branch of study called philosophy of mind, philosophers have applied the gift of reason to uncover key problems and to propose ways to tackle them. These include the problem of other minds, that is, how can you tell if a zombie, a robot, or a computer, a dog, or a chimpanzee, an amoeba, or even another human being, is conscious? That's the problem of other minds. The second problem that philosophers of mind study is what's called the mind-body problem, or the mind-body relation. And that problem is, how does consciousness happen in brains? Can minds exist apart from bodies? And finally, the third problem that philosophers of mind investigate is the problem of free will. Do we really exercise choice, or are all our actions determined by biology and environment? Such questions puzzle many of us at one time or another, and you don't need to be a philosopher to explore them. But philosophers can help. Good philosophers can be our guides into the intricacies of understanding the mind. The philosopher's gift, then, is the gift of reason. It's a gift we all share, and it comes with the ability to recognize not only its own limitations, but also to point to what is beyond. Once reason takes us as far as it can, true reason has the wisdom to say, this far, no further. Beyond this point lie paradox and mystery. But reason also knows that the limits of reason are not the limits of knowledge, and certainly not the limits of reality. Beyond reason lie other ways of knowing. From below, it is grounded in preverbal feelings and intuitions, and above, it projects imagination toward transverbal and transrational experiences. Prior to reason, interconnected feelings and altered states of consciousness appear to reason as some kind of magic, the indefinable domain of the shaman. Beyond reason, unities and communions of experience and higher states of consciousness appear to reason as ineffable and noetic, the infinite domain of the mystic. However, the domain of the philosopher is also vast, notwithstanding the fact that there are these vast realms beyond reason. Long before we can approach the uncertain shores of the magical or the mystical, there is much ground to cover in the territory of reason itself. Here, our guide is the philosopher, the guardian of linguistic meaning. The philosopher can teach us the power of precision, using the laser of logic to get our concepts and words in order. But such rigor and coherence are only part of the way to truth. Good philosophers also teach us that truth can sometimes be fuzzy, elusive, ineffable. But through imagination and intuition, they are approachable nonetheless. The wise philosopher teaches us to balance head and heart, reason and intuition, precision and mystery. But such balance stands or falls on our ability to think clearly, to see the distinctions that make up the nuanced shadows, shades, and contours of the reality presented to our minds. In a previous session, we began to do just that. Remember, we paid close attention to distinctions between different meanings of the words consciousness and energy. That was an example of using the philosopher's gift of clear thinking. So, let's summarize. The philosopher's gift is reason, and it helps us to navigate through a labyrinth of meanings, ordering and clarifying our thoughts to see if we are using concepts and language in ways that guide us toward understanding and truth. Getting clear on the meanings of the words we use to describe our experience is the first step on the journey into understanding consciousness. But the gift of reason is not unique or special to philosophers. It is a gift we all share. It comes as part of the package of who we are as conscious beings, capable of abstract thought. We don't need to have things immediately in front of us, detected by our senses, in order to explore them. We can, instead, abstract images and ideas from things and then carry them away in our heads where we can explore them at our leisure. We can use words and ideas as symbols to point to things that we no longer perceive or experience, and that we know about only through memory and thought. Imagination frees us from the confines of matter, space, and our senses, and launches us into the realms of symbols and speculation. And reason is our guide in this wild, wild land. Okay, let's now turn to the scientist's gift, the gift of observation and methodology. The scientist helps us explore how consciousness works. And this is another gift we all share. It's a gift we sometimes take for granted, a gift that reveals the world to us in all its naked glory. It is the gift of sensing. The ability we have to observe, to see and touch, to hear and smell and taste, the beauty, the vastness, the complexity, the diversity, the ordered systems, and sometimes the chaos of the world around us. We can call it the scientist's gift, a method of organizing what our senses reveal to us. But this, too, is not unique to scientists, and not even to our species. The scientist's gift is ultimately a method for gaining knowledge by observing the world using some or all of our senses, and of course their extensions or amplification through instruments such as microscopes, telescopes, computers, and data recorders. It is, in essence, a method for sensing energies. We live in a world of energy. We are surrounded by it, we consume it, we transform it, and in a way, we are it. As Einstein showed, all matter is a form of energy in his equation E equals mc squared. The entire world around us, the land, mountains, forests, deserts, oceans, cities, sky, and the vast, perhaps infinite, cosmos of the innumerable stars and galaxies. This is a world of energy vortices, fluxes, flows, currents, and vibrations. As embodied creatures, we are thoroughly embedded in this vast energy matrix as it streams in, through, and around us. And one of the greatest miracles of all is that not only are we part of this magnificent, eternal, infinite flux of energy, but we can know our part in it. According to the best understanding of physics, there are four known forms of energy. Two of them operate at the level of the very small, the microdomain of subatomic particles, called the strong and weak nuclear forces. A third form of energy operates most noticeably on the scale of the very large, the macrodomain of massive bodies such as planets, stars, and galaxies. This is familiar to us as gravitation. And the fourth form of energy operates along the vast spectrum in between, the domain of cosmic rays, light, and radio waves, familiar to us as the electromagnetic spectrum. From this vast pool of energy and information, our species is able to pick up only a very, very thin slice of the electromagnetic spectrum through our most dominant sense, vision, from red to violet light. Our other senses too, even our sense of gravity, are channeled through our nervous system that operates on electrochemical energy transmissions. They are all reducible, ultimately, to some kind of electromagnetism. In fact, everything we know about the world around us, many scientists and philosophers believe, is completely funneled through our detectors of electromagnetic radiation and energy pulses. Our five senses, sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste, rely on electromagnetic exchanges detected by or occurring in the body. Although the slice of the electromagnetic spectrum available to our senses is relatively tiny compared to the whole span of energies, nevertheless, that slice serves as a window on a vast and seemingly infinite expanse and variety of objects in the universe. So our senses serve us well. They have helped us survive through millions of years of evolution. They have helped us observe the patterns of climate and weather, the growth of plants, and the movement of animals, resulting in the invention of agriculture. They have helped us locate minerals and other materials for use in building civilizations. Our senses have helped us experiment with nature to discover and invent an impressive array of food sources and medicines. Our senses have helped us create sophisticated technologies for information acquisition, storage, and transmission. Without our senses, we would never have created the network of technologies that not only connect us around the globe, but also extend our senses themselves so that now we can reach out beyond the spectrum of visible stars and galaxies to the deepest depths of space and time, almost back to the very moment of creation itself. And that is a magnificent achievement. A Our senses connect our bodies to the vast network of energies and information that constantly stream and swirl in, through, and around us. And so, in a very real sense, our senses have given us the universe. But of course, that is not the whole story. Not only have our senses been aided in all this by other gifts, such as reason, imagination, and intuition, they have not by any means revealed, or in fact can ever reveal, one entire domain of reality. Our senses have given us the physical universe, but not the dimension of our interior experienced lives, the inner cosmos of consciousness. And perhaps the greatest irony facing every materialist is that the senses alone, without this interior cosmos, would be no more than windows opening onto a vast, unseen, silent, unfelt, odorless, and tasteless universe. By themselves, without the added spark of consciousness to experience the world, our eyes, ears, flesh, noses, and taste buds would be no more than shuttered windows. At the end of the chain of events, beginning at the sensory receptors, moving along activated nerve fibers, jumping across quantum synaptic gaps in the brain's enchanted network of neurons, nothing would be sensed without the mysterious presence of consciousness. To get from the senses to sensation, the miracle of consciousness is required. But the senses do play their part. In fact, an immensely important part. The senses act in concert with our other gifts of reason, intuition, and spiritual insight. Not only do they put us in touch with the whole panorama of the physical world, but they also connect us with and guide our participation in the majestic symphony of all being. The mysterious connection between our senses and consciousness, between perception and sensation, lies at the heart of the mind-body mystery. How do the senses inform our experience of what is happening in the world? How do physical impulses of electromagnetic energy get transformed into the colorful, lively, sensational qualities of felt ideas, images, thoughts, and emotions? How does experience connect with raw data? Well, clearly in our own case, our nervous system and brain play an immensely significant role in this process. We may never be able to tell what's going on in consciousness by simply looking at what's going on in a brain, but by exploring and discovering more and more about how the brain works and how these operations correlate with what is experienced in consciousness, we may come to learn quite a lot about which contents of consciousness are greatly affected by what happens in the brain. As holistic organisms, that is, as creatures with intimately related brains and minds, creatures of energy and consciousness, there is a world of discovery awaiting us within the brain. Science can lead us in this exploration, in exploring the fine details and connections within the brain, within its astronomically complex network of cells, and within the cells themselves, and the microneural structures down to the quantum level, by a rigorous combination of acute observation, recording, analysis, and evaluation of data, reporting results, proposing hypotheses and theories, and then testing and retesting the findings. It is a slow and meticulous process, but it often works to advance the frontiers of human knowledge. So the scientist's gift is a method for questing knowledge. It is not just the senses. It is a disciplined perception and attention to detail in the search for truth. It is, above all, uniquely a gift of method, a method for questing knowledge. By presenting us with a set of procedures for observing some specific thing or event in the world, registering the data observed, and testing them to see if they fit, that is, if they confirm or refute our expectations. Science helps us move step by painstaking step toward expanding our knowledge. The scientist's gift is the gift of empirical method. It's a procedure for organizing our observations and experiences to test if they fit what we, or others, think we or they already know. It is a rigorous discipline, as worthy and as capable of advancing toward truth as any spiritual practice. In fact, this method is the essence of spiritual practice too. Although it is empirical, this does not mean that the method is confined only to sensory observations of physical phenomena. The same procedure can be successfully applied to any quest for truth or knowledge, as long as it employs the three-step empirical method. First, follow a disciplined set of procedures by engaging in actual practices that, second, generate experiences, and third, comparing the data of these experiences with those reported by a community of peers. So I'll go over that again. It's really the essence, the three-step essence of the empirical method that can be applied to science or indeed to spirituality. So first, we follow a disciplined set of procedures and engage in actual practices. Second, these practices generate sets of experiences that we call data. And then third, we compare these data of the experiences we've just had with those reported by a community of peers who have undergone the same or similar practices. If we do this, and we get results that match those of others, then we know we have gained intersubjective or consensual knowledge, as distinct from mere subjective personal opinion. So this, in a nutshell, is the methodology followed by science. Although since Western science is focused on the physical universe, it relies greatly on knowledge gained through the physiological senses. But this is a habit of science. It is not a necessity. Science could just as well apply the three-step method to investigating data that do not rely on the physiological senses. Science does not have to confine its quest to the physical universe, not even to sensory knowledge. But due to force of habit lasting nearly four centuries, most scientists interested in the new field of consciousness studies still think they need to look for mind in the nuts and bolts of the physical universe, more specifically in a highly localized region of it found in the brain, and for many this means the human brain. As we learned in an earlier lecture, consciousness is not to be found in the physical universe. It is not to be found in the brain. Physical things are made of energy, and they occupy space. Consciousness is non-physical. It is not a form of energy, and does not occupy space. Scientists won't find mind by looking in matter, but they will and do find mind associated with matter, particularly the matter of the brain. So by exploring the fine details of the brain and paying close attention to how these are correlated with experiences in consciousness, scientists can learn quite a lot about the mechanisms of the mind. And we should note that mechanisms of the mind is in quote marks. More accurately, they can teach us a lot about how the brain works. But exploring the mechanisms of the brain, the nervous system, is not the only option open to scientists who want to study consciousness. There are other ways that do not involve looking for mind in the complex machinery of matter. In the early days of psychology, about 100 years or so ago, the most popular method was through introspection, by reflecting on the processes of consciousness and observing the way the mind works firsthand. Another similar method called phenomenology was developed by the philosopher Edmund Husserl. He attempted to explore the mind by paying rigorous attention to what shows up in consciousness when we block out or bracket opinions, beliefs, and theories. And, more recently, taking advantage of ancient spiritual traditions, often from the East, a growing number of consciousness explorers are engaging in meditation and other contemplative practices. Science does not have to confine its quest for consciousness to observations of objective processes in the brain, that is, to third-person objects. By using the three-step empirical method described above, science can also approach consciousness subjectively through introspection, phenomenology, and meditation. It can investigate consciousness from the first-person perspective. And there is a third approach open to science in its exploration of consciousness, a second-person perspective that explores consciousness intersubjectively as a phenomenon created in intimate encounters between two or more subjects. So now let's summarize the scientist's gift. In the domain of the physical universe, that is, the domain of energy and matter, the physiological senses play a crucial role. To the degree that science focuses on gaining knowledge of physical objects, the scientific method is dominated by sensory empiricism. But there are other ways of knowing. The full meaning of empiricism is what we know through experience, any experience, not just sensory perception. So now let's turn to some of these other ways of knowing, to what I call radical science, found in practices such as shamanism and mysticism. We first take a look at the shaman's gift, at why does consciousness work the way it does. A few years ago, a Stanford University anthropologist, Jeremy Narby, wrote a wonderful book, The Cosmic Serpent, where he described Amazonian shamans who possessed knowledge of DNA in plants. He had learned from friends in the rainforest that these shamans claimed to have gained knowledge about the essence of life from the plants themselves. They told him that the plants had spoken to them. At first, as a Western-trained scientist, Narby was sure they couldn't have meant this literally. Even if plants could convey intelligence or information, they don't have vocal cords, lips or tongues or teeth, and therefore could not speak. But perhaps they could communicate in a silent language, perhaps something like telepathy. Perhaps they could communicate through exchanges of photons. And photons, as we now know from Arthur Young, are non-local. They transcend time and space. According to both Arthur Young and the shamans in Jeremy Narby's experience, life is light. All life begins with light. We know from basic biology that life on Earth is fueled by the sun in the process known as photosynthesis. Green chlorophyll molecules in the leaves of plants literally capture the sun's energy in the form of photons. That's what photosynthesis means, making whole by light, building by light. The role of light in life goes far beyond chlorophyll molecules, however immensely important they may be. Below the level of the living cell lie the complex building blocks of life we know as DNA and proteins. Within the cell itself, and between various networks of cells, life is sustained moment to moment by vastly complex and rapidly changing networks of biochemical reactions. Something like 10 million cells die in your body every second. These must be replaced at precisely the same rate, in exactly the right locations, for integrity or health of your body to be maintained. How do the individual cells know where and when to grow? How does the body as a whole coordinate and orchestrate this vast symphony of the chemistry of life? Where does the body's intelligence come from to achieve all of this? According to Arthur Young, it is all a question of quantum timing. All chemical reactions involve sharing or exchanging of electrons between molecules. These electromagnetic interactions are, in fact, exchanges of photons, quanta of action. The spinning or rotating quantum of action snatches energy from the environment, it stores it and builds it up in order and organization in the form of DNA and living cells, and so the first steps of life begin. Quantum choice and timing, therefore, lie behind the amazing varieties of living forms that populate our oceans, marshlands, forests, mountains, lakes, rivers, plains, prairies, in fact, every crack and crevice on our planet where life has taken hold. Light, or photons, exchanged between DNA and cells, forms the ultimate base of the entire global economy of life. Life, quite literally, is light. And that is the key message for biology from Arthur Young. It matches the visionary wisdom common to the world's shamanic traditions about the interrelatedness of life and light. In a very real sense, life on Earth is borrowed light, forming the world's most fundamental living economic system, what we might call the economy of light. All life shares in an interdependent network of exchanges of light. Instead of food chains, indigenous wisdom prefers to talk in terms we might translate as light economies, or energy circulations, or spirit exchanges. The shamanic perspective recognizes that all life forms are integral parts of a tightly knit system. For the shaman, true photosynthesis occurs at the level of life, literally making whole by sharing or bringing together of light. Arthur Young points out that the photons involved in life are the very same quanta that began the long evolutionary descent through the levels of nuclear forces into the atoms and molecules of matter. Frozen in matter, the quantum still retains a minute degree of freedom, which science recognizes as the quantum of uncertainty. This shows up as spontaneous action, for example, in quantum jumps. From Young's perspective, this uncertainty is the final residue of quantum purpose. It's what frees spirit from the frozen grip of dense matter to begin the process of life and open the way for an evolutionary ascent back towards spirit. Jeremy Narby had studied at Stanford University and among the Kishari people in the Amazon rainforests of Peru. His central message is that shamanic knowledge, gained from direct communication with certain hallucinogenic plants, predates by centuries, if not millennia, modern scientific data about the basis of life. He notes that shamanic visions of entwined or double serpents, recorded throughout history and across the world, foreshadowed in remarkable detail the 20th century discovery of the double helix, or the twisted ladder structure of DNA, the fundamental molecules of life. Many shamans use special plant guides, such as ayahuasca, peyote, or psilocybin mushrooms, along with special chants, whistles, drumming, or dancing, to prepare the mind for receiving altered states of consciousness capable of penetrating alternative realities. How had Narby hooked together his understanding of Western molecular biology, particularly knowledge of DNA, and the visionary insights of the shamans? And how does this tie in with Arthur Young's account of the evolutionary journey from light to enlightenment? Well, after some shrewd detective work, Narby discovered that the key had to be photons. He came to believe that the visionary dreams that the shamans had told him about were actually conversations they'd had with spirits contained in the hallucinatory plants. and that these conveyed accurate knowledge about DNA and the role of light in all living systems. Under normal circumstances, we cannot see DNA. It took the invention of powerful electron microscopes before Western science could focus in on the structure of these esoteric molecules. But whether or not we can see them, their presence throughout our bodies is fundamental. And their quantity is staggering. As Narby points out, there are approximately 125 billion miles of DNA in a human body. Your personal DNA is long enough to wrap around the Earth 5 million times. How could we access this incredible database of life without the aid of modern science and immensely complex technology? How do shamans do so? This was the puzzle Narby set himself, and like a true scientific sleuth, he tracked down evidence from different sources in science, mythology, anthropology, and shamanism, paying attention to the most unlikely clues. Then, using a technique he called defocalization, learned from his shaman guide, he started putting together the pieces. He began to see common forms in the teachings of the various disciplines. Most dramatic of all the clues was the form common to the scientific picture of DNA as a double helix, and the shamanic description of the essence of life as entwined cosmic serpents. Narby also learned that DNA is actually a kind of crystal that emits photons. All living things emit light. And this, he saw, could account for a wide variety of phenomena associated with shamanic and other non-sensory, non-ordinary realities, such as dreams, visions, auras, subtle bodies, near-death experiences of light bodies that we might call angels. Narby had written, quote, "In their visions, shamans take their consciousness down to the molecular level and gain access to information related to DNA, which they call animate essences or spirits." Unquote. One of his indigenous informants, comparing shamanic spirits to radio waves, had said, "Once you turn on the radio, you can pick them up. Well, it's like that with souls. With ayahuasca, you can see them and hear them." When a shaman ingests ayahuasca, peyote, or some other hallucinogen, or entheogen, Narby concluded that certain molecules in those substances activate receptors in the brain cells, which in turn trigger a cascade of electrochemical reactions inside the brain's neurons. This stimulates the cell's DNA and the emission of visible photons. The result? Shamans literally see three-dimensional images, such as cosmic serpents. However, to account for the accurate information shamans ostensibly possessed of DNA and the medicinal qualities of plants and animals, it would not be sufficient for DNA to merely emit photons. It would also have to be capable of receiving them. Otherwise, the shamanic visions could be dismissed by Western minds as mere hallucinations. So Narby had to find a suitable mechanism for the human brain, DNA to receive information in the form of photons from the sacred plants. And he found it in crystals. He discovered that almost all experiments that measure biophotons, that is, photons associated with living tissue, that almost all of these photons make use of quartz. And quartz is a crystal whose atoms vibrate at very stable frequencies. This makes quartz crystals excellent receptors and emitters of photons. Narby noted that not only is quartz used abundantly in electronic technologies such as radios and watches, it is also widely used by shamans around the world. He speculated, I quote, "What if shamanic spirits were none other than the biophotons emitted by all the cells of the world and were picked up, amplified, and transmitted by shamans, by the quartz crystals of shamans? This would mean that spirits are beings of pure light, as has always been claimed. Unquote. The clincher for Narbi was the realization that large sections of DNA form periodic crystals, just like quartz. And just like quartz, they could also pick up photons. This is not junk DNA, Narbi noted, despite what many biologists claim. Based on solid evidence from science and backed by thousands of years of shamanic wisdom, Narbi came to a revolutionary conclusion. When the shaman's DNA is stimulated by the psychoactive chemicals in sacred plants, such as ayahuasca or peyote, it not only emits biophotons, but also increases its capacity to tune into and receive photons emitted anywhere in the world. The entire planet, and perhaps the entire cosmos, is covered by a complex network of DNA-based life forms, all emitting photons carrying information about their host organisms. Any suitably sensitized DNA, such as the DNA in a shaman's brain cells, could pick up images and information from any living being anywhere in this global and perhaps cosmic network. Since photons are non-local, that global network of messages could extend to the entire universe. Shamans may be picking up coded information not only from the plants and animals of the earth, but also from the heavens. If photons are messages of the gods, shamans may be their emissaries on earth. What if cosmic intelligence, the mind in the cosmos that shamans and mystics alike have reported in all cultures down through the centuries, what if cosmic intelligence is carried by photons from stars and galaxies throughout the universe? As manifest photons in the domain of space and time, they would travel at the speed of light, and by that reckoning would take millions or billions of years to reach our solar system. And of course, that is precisely what we do see when we look into the night sky. We see the universe as it was many millions or billions of years ago. But for unmanifest photons, that is, photons as they experience themselves, not as seen by some observer, there is no time or space. They are thoroughly non-local. True, they cannot communicate information or energy, no physical signals, but as messengers of meaning, of presence, of consciousness, they could be truly universal. The why of consciousness, then, its purpose, is to be a messenger of the gods, helping to unite the cosmos across time and space through a universal sharing of meaning and presence. One mind. Which takes us to the mystic's gift. And the question, who works consciousness? To receive the mystic's gift, we have to develop or evolve to what Arthur Young calls the level one, or stage seven, the domain of spirit. And for that, we have to move into the realm of silence, into those spaces between words and between breaths, into the mysterious nothingness that gives birth to being. It is the wordless domain beyond even the reach of intuition. Now, of course, I cannot tell you about it, even if I had been there myself. But I can tell you a little about some of the final steps mystics have reported after crossing that threshold and returning. I'll begin with a form of thinking and a kind of mysticism almost alien to modern Western minds. I could have chosen almost any culture, Indian, Australian, Native American, Celtic, Nordic, Polynesian, to make the same points. But I have a particular affinity with Taoist wisdom, rooted in a shamanic sensitivity to nature, and therefore a fine example of a transition from shamanism to mysticism. So I've decided to start with China. From ancient times, the Chinese distinguished two types of knowledge that correspond roughly to what Westerners call objective and subjective knowledge. Westerners tend to rely heavily on the first kind, the objective knowledge, because it is amenable to reason. Subjective knowledge, we feel, is so often out of bounds to reason that we tend to dismiss it as knowledge at all. From early childhood, our thinking patterns are mapped along this groove of objectivity. For the most part, it has served us well in dealing with the material world, though it has now brought us and the rest of nature into a global crisis. Western society is now finding out that thinking dominated by reason does not work well when dealing with the far more subtle problems of human relations and consciousness. By confining knowledge to objective events, Western scientific thinking can find no place for thinking itself. I'll repeat that. By confining knowledge to objective events, Western scientific thinking can find no place for thinking itself. Modern knowledge of material things is undoubtedly great, but modern Western knowledge of the spirit world is almost nil. And of how the two worlds come together, Western culture seems to know nothing at all. Things developed very differently in China. The Taoists came from an old tradition with roots stretching back to the twilight days of tribal sorcerers, adept at working with nature. Often, they were solitary hermits who lived in inaccessible places on the sides of mountains and in hidden valleys. They were not organized into any system or collective, but they had in common a refusal to be tied to any conventions, preferring to develop a feel for the natural way by living close to the earth. The readiness of Taoists to touch the earth and their mystical rather than rational approach to nature was very different from the way of scientific knowledge in the West. Taoist shamans were experts at divination, using as oracles fire and smoke, bones, tortoise shells, and sticks. Always their way was to return to original nature, a returning to the source. A famous Taoist saying from the sage Lao Tzu is, "Learning consists in adding to our original stock piece by piece. The sage returns to Tao by subtracting from his knowledge day by day until he has reached inactivity." Doing nothing, everything happens. This expresses the essence of Taoist wisdom. They call it Wu Wei, which means action through non-action. Wu Wei does not simply mean doing nothing. There is no easy translation in English, but it definitely means action that is not contrary to nature, action that is not forced in any way. Hence, Wu Wei is sometimes called actionless activity. Like water following the path of least resistance, Wu Wei is like light filling all space by not using any energy at all, just as Arthur Young described the photon and the quantum of action. Non-action carries also an ethical tone. It implies not doing anything violent or aggressive, though it refers more to the attitude behind the action than to the nature of the action itself. Wu Wei is non-motivated action. Action performed not as a means to a desired end, but as its own reward. Wu Wei is spontaneous action that simply lets things be. Lao Tzu's advice applies not only to how we deal with nature, it also is good for individuals who wish to control or purify their minds. For ordinary folk, actions normally spring from the incessant buzzing and never-ending eternal chattering of the monkey mind. Therefore, in order to have our actions flow in the spirit of Wu Wei, we need to apply it to the mind as well. Unless we silence the internal dialogue by leaving the mind alone, our actions will reflect the mind's confusion. Have you noticed? The more you try to silence your mind, the more you disturb it. and the faster it buzzes, like restless bees. It is best to leave the mind alone, to follow its natural rhythms and spontaneous adaptations as circumstances change. The only way to stop the mind is to stop thinking about it. Otherwise, we just make matters worse. Picture the mind as a muddy pool. The more you try to clear it, the more you agitate it, making the water even murkier. If you want clear water, let it alone to settle by itself. When we are thinking about what we should do or what we should be, we block the natural, spontaneous awareness of life. Yet thinking is part of our natural way too. It would be false and unnatural to force ourselves to stop thinking. All we need to do is realize that our thoughts are happenings along the way, just as much as anything outside our heads. What matters is paying close attention to whatever is unfolding here and now. The central idea of this tradition is the Tao, which means the way. It is the stream of change, the flow of time, the course of life, the path to perfection, the current of consciousness, the source of everything and nothing. To look for Tao in the mind, or to look for Tao using the mind, is a bit like looking for electricity in an electric current. Yes, it is there. We see its effects, but we don't know what it is. The more we try to grasp it with the mind, the more it eludes us. Tao achieves everything by doing nothing, and the mind can achieve awareness of Tao only by following the way of Tao. Thoughts or words cannot capture this experience any more than a searchlight can capture darkness. And this is not at all surprising, for as Lao Tzu said, the Tao that can be spoken of is not the real Tao, is not the eternal Tao. Experience itself, in itself, is wordless. The more we get involved in trying to figure things out, the less room there is for the simple but beautiful everyday experiences that Taoists and Zen masters tell us are the basis of Satori, our enlightenment. Intuition serves us by continually filling in the gaps between bits of knowledge produced by reason. Our ability to enrich intellect with intuitive understanding allows us to make advances in knowledge. It is intuition, with its spontaneous grasp of wholeness, that gives us knowledge of the interrelatedness and continuity of nature. When logic and reason fail, intuition takes over. But just as reason is limited, sooner or later we find ourselves hesitating at the blurred boundaries of intuitive knowledge. At this point, we must go beyond both reason and intuition and lose ourselves in the misty, floating, ever-changing continuum that we cannot know, only experience. This is the realm of sage knowledge, of no knowledge, described by Taoist mystics. No knowledge is what I have called paradox consciousness. It is not really knowledge in the sense ordinarily understood in the West, which usually involves the selection or abstraction of specific details. Western knowledge is anchored in the duality of subject and object. No knowledge makes no such distinction. It involves an understanding of what the Chinese called wu, or non-being. Wu transcends the realms of concepts and matter and is not concerned with specific qualities or quantities. There are no separate entities and distinct phenomena. These are the objects of ordinary, conventional knowledge. The wu itself cannot be such an object. To appreciate the wu, one must forget all distinctions and definitions and experience the silent spontaneity of no knowledge. The scientist or philosopher who relies solely on rational knowledge becomes an artificial spectator of nature. If a scientist opens up to no knowledge, to paradox consciousness, he or she becomes a participant in nature and shares the ineffable understanding of what is. All true mental creativity springs from the shafts of wisdom connecting this ineffable region with some rational or artistic expression. And just as there is no method for translating intuitive knowledge successfully and completely into rational language, the ineffability of no knowledge makes it even less translatable. You must rely on your own ineffable awareness of the ineffable to know no knowledge. And no knowledge is not restricted to human consciousness. It is common to all nature, and is communicated wordlessly between humans and mammals, birds and reptiles, trees, flowers and insects, oceans and winds. It is the silent voice informing us how nature appears to itself, not as it appears to the gaze of a rational mind. It is the language of nature, the embodied language of our ancestors when they sang with the symphony of the wild and shared its subtle messages before the stones fell silent. Through no knowledge, the Taoist artist captures or reflects the bambooishness of the bamboo. As one Chinese scholar summed it up, with rational knowledge, one is in tune with the scientific man. With intuitive knowledge added, one is in tune with the total man. And with no knowledge added, one is in tune with nature. So I want to conclude this session on different ways of knowing by returning to Arthur Young's four-level model of the evolution of consciousness. Now remember, according to Young, the cosmos is structured in four levels of being, each with its own powers. Level one, the level of spirit or the ultimate, is the domain of pure potential, the completely unconstrained photon or quantum of action. It is dimensionless, point-like, beyond time, beyond space. Level two, the level of the soul, is the domain of time, of forces and emotions. Here, spirit has given up one degree of freedom and generated the single dimension of time. It is linear, projective. Level three is the level of mind, the domain of space, of concepts, of analysis. Here, spirit has given up another 2 degrees of freedom and generated the dimensions of extension. It is planar, the realm of surfaces. And level four, the level of matter. This is the domain of time-space, of solid objects. Here, spirit has given up all its degrees of freedom except for the final quantum of uncertainty. Just enough wiggle room is left to choose to turn and to begin the homeward journey towards spirit. These are ontological levels. They are levels of being. However, Young's model also reminds us that there are different epistemologies, different ways of knowing, associated with each level. Let's take them briefly in reverse order. Level four, the level of matter. To know objects in space-time, we need to perceive them with our senses. At this level, we need to employ the scientist's gift and the method of sensory empiricism. This is the realm of sensory intelligence. Moving up to level three, the level of mind, to know objects in the abstract domain of space, we need to use the philosopher's gift of language, of reason and rationality. We need to be able to move around and compare different words and ideas. This is the realm of intellectual intelligence. Then moving up to level two, the level of soul, here to know entities in the domain of soul, of forces, and the flow of time, we need to open up to the shaman's gift of feeling and emotion. This is the realm of emotional intelligence, of feeling intelligence. And finally, all the way up to level one, the level of spirit, here to know the domain of spirit, the dimensionless domain of the ground of all being, we need to let go of all separation between knower and known, between subject and object, between knowing and being. Here we must open to the mystic's gift of transcendence, beyond all distinctions, beyond all thought, even beyond knowledge and experience itself. This is the silent realm of spiritual wisdom. And so we come to the end of Session 7, Multiple Ways of Knowing. In the next session, I will introduce a personal narrative about how I came to realize the limitations of mainstream academic philosophy and how I opened to a different kind of philosophy, more aligned with indigenous and spiritual wisdom. I will tell the story of my own awakening and how I came to understand the important difference between reason-based consciousness and feeling-based consciousness.